This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead by Sheryl Sandberg with Nell Scovell. Read for you by Elisa Donovan. Introduction. Internalizing the Revolution. I got pregnant with my first child in the summer of 2004. At the time, I was running the online sales and operations groups at Google. I had joined the company 3.5 years earlier when it was an obscure startup with a few hundred employees in a rundown office building. By my first trimester, Google had grown into a company of thousands and moved into a multi-building campus. My pregnancy was not easy. The typical morning sickness that often accompanies the first trimester affected me every day for 9 long months. I gained almost 70 pounds, and my feet swelled 2 entire shoe sizes, turning into odd-shaped lumps I could see only when they were propped up on a coffee table. A particularly sensitive Google engineer announced that Project Whale was named after me. One day, after a rough morning spent staring at the bottom of the toilet, I had to rush to make an important client meeting. Google was growing so quickly that parking was an ongoing problem, and the only spot I could find was quite far away. I sprinted across the parking lot, which in reality meant lumbering a bit more quickly than my absurdly slow pregnancy crawl. This only made my nausea worse, and I arrived at the meeting praying that a sales pitch was the only thing that would come out of my mouth. That night, I recounted these troubles to my husband, Dave. He pointed out that Yahoo, where he worked at the time, had designated parking for expectant mothers at the front of each building. The next day, I marched in, or more like waddled in, to see Google founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin in their office, which was really just a large room with toys and gadgets strewn all over the floor. I found Sergey in a yoga position in the corner and announced that we needed pregnancy parking, preferably sooner rather than later. He looked up at me and agreed immediately, noting that he had never thought about it before. To this day, I'm embarrassed that I didn't realize that pregnant women needed reserved parking until I experienced my own aching feet. As one of Google's most senior women, didn't I have a special responsibility to think of this? But like Sergey, it had never occurred to me. The other pregnant women must have suffered in silence, not wanting to ask for special treatment. Or maybe they lacked the confidence or seniority to demand that the problem be fixed. Having one pregnant woman at the top, even one who looked like a whale, made the difference. Today in the United States and the developed world, women are better off than ever. We stand on the shoulders of the women who came before us, women who had to fight for the rights that we now take for granted. In 1947, Anita Summers, the mother of my longtime mentor Larry Summers, was hired as an economist by the Standard Oil Company. When she accepted the job, her new boss said to her, "I am so glad to have you. I figure I am getting the same brains for less money." Her reaction to this was to feel flattered. It was a huge compliment to be told that she had the same brains as a man. It would have been unthinkable for her to ask for equal compensation. We feel even more grateful when we compare our lives to those of other women around the world. There are still countries that deny women basic civil rights. Worldwide, about 4.4 million women and girls are trapped in the sex trade. In places like Afghanistan and Sudan, girls receive little or no education. Wives are treated as the property of their husbands, and women who are raped are routinely cast out of their homes for disgracing their families. Some rape victims are even sent to jail for committing a moral crime. We are centuries ahead of the unacceptable treatment of women in these countries. But knowing that things could be worse should not stop us from trying to make them better. When the suffragettes marched in the streets, they envisioned a world where men and women would be truly equal. A century later, we are still squinting, trying to bring that vision into focus. The blunt truth is that men still run the world. Of the 195 independent countries in the world, only 17 are led by women. Women hold just 20% of seats in parliaments globally. In the United States, where we pride ourselves on liberty and justice for all, the gender division of leadership roles is not much better. Women became 50% of the college graduates in the United States in the early 1980s. Since then, women have slowly and steadily advanced, earning more and more of the college degrees, taking more of the entry-level jobs, and entering more fields previously dominated by men. Despite these gains, the percentage of women at the top of corporate America has barely budged over the past decade. A meager 21 of the Fortune 500 CEOs are women. Women hold about 14% of executive officer positions, 17% of board seats, and constitute 18% of our elected congressional officials. The gap is even worse for women of color, who hold just 4% of top corporate jobs, 3% of board seats, and 5% of congressional seats. While women continue to outpace men in educational achievement, we have ceased making real progress at the top of any industry. This means that when it comes to making the decisions that most affect our world, women's voices are not heard equally. Progress remains equally sluggish when it comes to compensation. In 1970, American women were paid 59 cents for every dollar their male counterparts made. By 2010, women had protested, fought, and worked their butts off to raise that compensation to 77 cents for every dollar men made. As activist Marlo Thomas wryly joked on Equal Pay Day 2011, 40 years and 18 cents. A dozen eggs have gone up 10 times that amount. I have watched these disheartening events from a front row seat. I graduated from college in 1991 and from business school in 1995. In each entry-level job after graduation, my colleagues were a balanced mix of male and female. I saw that the senior leaders were almost entirely male, but I thought that was due to historical discrimination against women. The proverbial glass ceiling had been cracked in almost every industry, and I believed that it was just a matter of time until my generation took our fair share of the leadership roles. But with each passing year, fewer and fewer of my colleagues were women. More and more often, I was the only woman in the room. Being the sole woman has resulted in some awkward yet revealing situations. 2 years after I joined Facebook as chief operating officer, our chief financial officer departed suddenly, and I had to step in to complete a funding round. Since I had spent my career in operations, not finance, the process of raising capital was new and a bit scary. My team and I flew to New York for the initial pitch to private equity firms. Our first meeting was held in the kind of corporate office featured in movies, complete with a sprawling view of Manhattan. I offered an overview of our business and answered questions. So far, so good. Then someone suggested that we break for a few minutes. I turned to the senior partner and asked where the women's restroom was. He stared at me blankly. My question had completely stumped him. I asked, "How long have you been in this office?" And he said, "1 year." "Am I the only woman to have pitched a deal here in an entire year?" "I think so," he said, adding, "Or maybe you're the only one who had to use the bathroom." It has been more than 2 decades since I entered the workforce, and so much is still the same. It is time for us to face the fact that our revolution has stalled. The promise of equality is not the same as true equality. A truly equal world would be one where women ran half our countries and companies, and men ran half our homes. I believe that this would be a better world. The laws of economics and many studies of diversity tell us that if we tapped the entire pool of human resources and talent, our collective performance would improve. Legendary investor Warren Buffett has stated generously that one of the reasons for his great success was that he was competing with only half of the population. The Warren Buffetts of my generation are still largely enjoying this advantage. When more people get in the race, more records will be broken, and the achievements will extend beyond those individuals to benefit us all. The night before Lema Bowie won the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize for helping to lead the women's protests that toppled Liberia's dictator. She was at a book party in my home. We were celebrating the publication of her autobiography, Mighty Be Our Powers. But it was a somber night. A guest asked her how American women could help those who experienced the horrors and mass rapes of war in places like Liberia. Her response was four simple words. More women in power. Layma and I could not have come from more different backgrounds, and yet we have both arrived at the same conclusion. Conditions for all women will improve when there are more women in leadership roles giving strong and powerful voice to their needs and concerns. This brings us to the obvious question. How? How are we going to take down the barriers that prevent more women from getting to the top? Women face real obstacles in the professional world, including blatant and subtle sexism, discrimination, and sexual harassment. Too few workplaces offer the flexibility and access to childcare and parental leave that are necessary for pursuing a career while raising children. Men have an easier time finding the mentors and sponsors who are invaluable for career progression. Plus, women have to prove themselves to a far greater extent than men do. And this is not just in our heads. A 2011 McKinsey report noted that men are promoted based on potential, while women are promoted based on past accomplishments. In addition to the external barriers erected by society, women are hindered by barriers that exist within ourselves. We hold ourselves back in ways both big and small, by lacking self-confidence, by not raising our hands, and by pulling back when we should be leaning in. We internalize the negative messages we get throughout our lives, the messages that say it's wrong to be outspoken, aggressive, more powerful than men. We lower our own expectations of what we can achieve. We continue to do the majority of the housework and childcare. We compromise our career goals to make room for partners and children who may not even exist yet. Compared to our male colleagues, fewer of us aspire to senior positions. This is not a list of things other women have done. I have made every mistake on this list. At times, I still do. My argument is that getting rid of these internal barriers is critical to gaining power. Others have argued that women can get to the top only when the institutional barriers are gone. This is the ultimate chicken and egg situation. The chicken. Women will tear down the external barriers once we achieve leadership roles. We will march into our bosses' offices and demand what we need, including pregnancy parking. Or better yet, we'll become bosses and make sure all women have what they need. The egg. We need to eliminate the external barriers to get women into those roles in the first place. Both sides are right. So rather than engage in philosophical arguments over which comes first, let's agree to wage battles on both fronts. They are equally important. I am encouraging women to address the chicken, but I fully support those who are focusing on the egg. Internal obstacles are rarely discussed and often underplayed. Throughout my life, I was told over and over about inequalities in the workplace and how hard it would be to have a career and a family. I rarely heard anything, however, about the ways I might hold myself back. These internal obstacles deserve a lot more attention, in part because they are under our own control. We can dismantle the hurdles in ourselves today. We can start this very moment. I never thought I would write a book. I am not a scholar, a journalist, or a sociologist. But I decided to speak out after talking to hundreds of women, listening to their struggles, sharing my own, and realizing that the gains we have made are not enough and may even be slipping. The first chapter of this book lays out some of the complex challenges women face. Each subsequent chapter focuses on an adjustment or difference that we can make ourselves. Increasing our self-confidence, sit at the table. Getting our partners to do more at home. Make your partner a real partner. Not holding ourselves to unattainable standards. The myth of doing it all. I do not pretend to have perfect solutions to these deep and complicated issues. I rely on hard data, academic research, my own observations, and lessons I have learned along the way. This book is not a memoir, although I have included stories about my life. It is not a self-help book, although I truly hope it helps. It is not a book on career management, although I offer advice in that area. It is not a feminist manifesto. Okay, it is sort of a feminist manifesto, but one that I hope inspires men as much as it inspires women. Whatever this book is, I am writing it for any woman who wants to increase her chances of making it to the top of her field or pursue any goal vigorously. This includes women at all stages of their lives and careers, from those who are just starting out to those who are taking a break and may want to jump back in. I am also writing this for any man who wants to understand what a woman, a colleague, wife, mother, or daughter, is up against so that he can do his part to build an equal world. This book makes the case for leaning in, for being ambitious in any pursuit. And while I believe that increasing the number of women in positions of power is a necessary element of true equality, I do not believe that there is one definition of success or happiness. Not all women want careers. Not all women want children. Not all women want both. I would never advocate that we should all have the same objectives. Many people are not interested in acquiring power, not because they lack ambition, but because they are living their lives as they desire. Some of the most important contributions to our world are made by caring for one person at a time. We each have to chart our own unique course and define which goals fit our lives, values, and dreams. I am also acutely aware that the vast majority of women are struggling to make ends meet and take care of their families. Parts of this book will be most relevant to women fortunate enough to have choices about how much and when and where to work. Other parts apply to situations that women face in every workplace, within every community, and in every home. If we can succeed in adding more female voices at the highest levels, we will expand opportunities and extend fairer treatment to all. Some, especially other women in business, have cautioned me about speaking out publicly on these issues. When I have spoken out anyway, several of my comments have upset people of both genders. I know some believe that by focusing on what women can change themselves, pressing them to lean in, it seems like I am letting our institutions off the hook. Or even worse, they accuse me of blaming the victim. Far from blaming the victim, I believe that female leaders are key to the solution. Some critics will also point out that it is much easier for me to lean in, since my financial resources allow me to afford any help I need. My intention is to offer advice that would have been useful to me long before I had heard of Google or Facebook, and that will resonate with women in a broad range of circumstances. I have heard these criticisms in the past, and I know that I will hear them, and others, in the future. My hope is that my message will be judged on its merits. We can't avoid this conversation. This issue transcends all of us. The time is long overdue to encourage more women to dream the possible dream and encourage more men to support women in the workforce and in the home. We can reignite the revolution by internalizing the revolution. The shift to a more equal world will happen person by person. We move closer to the larger goal of true equality with each woman who leans in. Chapter 1. The Leadership Ambition Gap. What would you do if you weren't afraid? My grandmother, Rosalind Einhorn, was born exactly 52 years before I was, on August 28, 1917. Like many poor Jewish families in the boroughs of New York City, hers lived in a small, crowded apartment close to their relatives. Her parents, aunts, and uncles addressed her male cousins by their given names, but she and her sister were referred to only as girly. During the Depression, my grandmother was pulled out of Morris High School to help support the household by sewing fabric flowers onto undergarments that her mother could resell for a tiny profit. No one in the community would have considered taking a boy out of school. A boy's education was the family's hope to move up the financial and social ladder. Education for girls, however, was less important both financially, since they were unlikely to contribute to the family's income, and culturally, since boys were expected to study the Torah while girls were expected to run a proper home. Luckily for my grandmother, a local teacher insisted that her parents put her back into school. She went on not only to finish high school, but to graduate from UC Berkeley. After college, Girlie worked selling pocketbooks and accessories at David's Fifth Avenue. When she left her job to marry my grandfather, family legend has it that David's had to hire 4 people to replace her. Years later, when my grandfather's paint business was struggling, she jumped in and took some of the hard steps he was reluctant to take, helping to save the family from financial ruin. She displayed her business acumen again in her 40s. After being diagnosed with breast cancer, she beat it and then dedicated herself to raising money for the clinic that treated her by selling knockoff watches out of the trunk of her car. Girlie ended up with a profit margin that Apple would envy. I have never met anyone with more energy and determination than my grandmother. When Warren Buffett talks about competing against only half of the population, I think about her and wonder how different her life might have been if she had been born half a century later. When my grandmother had children of her own, my mother and her 2 brothers, she emphasized education for all of them. My mother attended the University of Pennsylvania, where classes were co-ed. When she graduated in 1965 with a degree in French literature, she surveyed a workforce that she believed consisted of 2 career options for women: teaching or nursing. She chose teaching. She began a PhD program, got married, and then dropped out when she became pregnant with me. It was thought to be a sign of weakness if a husband needed his wife's help to support their family. So my mother became a stay-at-home parent and an active volunteer. The centuries-old division of labor stood. Even though I grew up in a traditional home, my parents had the same expectations for me, my sister, and my brother. All 3 of us were encouraged to excel in school, do equal chores, and engage in extracurricular activities. We were all supposed to be athletic, too. My brother and sister joined sports teams, but I was the kid who got picked last in gym. Despite my athletic shortcomings, I was raised to believe that girls could do anything boys could do, and that all career paths were open to me. When I arrived at college in the fall of 1987, my classmates of both genders seemed equally focused on academics. I don't remember thinking about my future career differently from the male students. I also don't remember any conversations about someday balancing work and children. My friends and I assumed that we would have both. Men and women competed openly and aggressively with one another in classes, activities, and job interviews. Just 2 generations removed from my grandmother, the playing field seemed to be level. But more than 20 years after my college graduation, the world has not evolved nearly as much as I believed it would. Almost all of my male classmates work in professional settings. Some of my female classmates work full-time or part-time outside the home, and just as many are stay-at-home mothers and volunteers like my mom. This mirrors the national trend. In comparison to their male counterparts, highly trained women are scaling back and dropping out of the workforce in high numbers. In turn, these diverging percentages teach institutions and mentors to invest more in men, who are statistically more likely to stay. Judith Rodin, president of the Rockefeller Foundation and the first woman to serve as president of an Ivy League university, once remarked to an audience of women my age, "My generation fought so hard to give all of you choices. We believe in choices. But choosing to leave the workforce was not the choice we thought so many of you would make." So what happened? My generation was raised in an era of increasing equality a trend we thought would continue. In retrospect, we were naive and idealistic. Integrating professional and personal aspirations proved far more challenging than we had imagined. During the same years that our careers demanded maximum time investment, our biology demanded that we have children. Our partners did not share the housework and child-rearing, so we found ourselves with two full-time jobs. The workplace did not evolve to give us the flexibility we needed to fulfill our responsibilities at home. We anticipated none of this. We were caught by surprise. If my generation was too naive, the generations that have followed may be too practical. We knew too little, and now girls know too much. Girls growing up today are not the first generation to have equal opportunity, but they are the first to know that all that opportunity does not necessarily translate into professional achievement. Many of these girls watch their mothers try to do it all and then decide that something had to give. That something was usually their careers. There's no doubt that women had the skills to lead in the workplace. Girls are increasingly outperforming boys in the classroom, earning about 57% of the undergraduate and 60% of the master's degrees in the United States. This gender gap in academic achievement has even caused some to worry about the end of men. But while compliant, raise your hand and speak when called on behaviors might be rewarded in school, they are less valued in the workplace. Career progression often depends upon taking risks and advocating for oneself, traits that girls are discouraged from exhibiting. This may explain why girls' academic gains have not yet translated into significantly higher numbers of women in top jobs. The pipeline that supplies the educated workforce is chock full of women at the entry level, but by the time that same pipeline is filling leadership positions, it is overwhelmingly stocked with men. There are so many reasons for this winnowing out, but one important contributor is a leadership ambition gap. Of course, many individual women are as professionally ambitious as any individual man. Yet, drilling down, the data clearly indicate that in field after field, more men than women aspire to the most senior jobs. A 2012 McKinsey survey of more than 4,000 employees of leading companies found that 36% of the men wanted to become CEOs, compared to only 18% of the women. When jobs are described as powerful, challenging, and involving high levels of responsibility, they appeal to more men than women. And while the ambition gap is most pronounced at the highest levels, the underlying dynamic is evident at every step of the career ladder. A survey of college students found that more men than women chose reaching a managerial level as a career priority in the first 3 years after graduating. Even among highly educated professional men and women, more men than women describe themselves as ambitious. There is some hope that a shift is starting to occur in the next generation. A 2012 Pew study found for the first time that among young people ages 18 to 34, more young women, 66%, than young men, 59%, rated success in a high-paying career or profession as important to their lives. A recent survey of millennials found that women were just as likely to describe themselves as ambitious as men. Although this is an improvement, even among this demographic, the leadership ambition gap remains. Millennial women are less likely than millennial men to agree that the statement, "I aspire to a leadership role in whatever field I ultimately work," describes them very well. Millennial women were also less likely than their male peers to characterize themselves as leaders, visionaries, self-confident, and willing to take risks. Since more men aim for leadership roles, it is not surprising that they obtain them, especially given all the other obstacles that women have to overcome. This pattern starts long before they enter the workforce. Author Samantha Edis and her husband read their daughter's kindergarten yearbook, where each child answered the question, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" They noted that several of the boys wanted to be president. None of the girls did. Current data suggest that when these girls become women, they will continue to feel the same way. In middle school, more boys than girls aspire to leadership roles in future careers. At the top 50 colleges, less than a third of student government presidents are women. Professional ambition is expected of men, but is optional, or worse, sometimes even a negative, for women. "She is very ambitious," is not a compliment in our culture. Aggressive and hard-charging women violate unwritten rules about acceptable social conduct. Men are continually applauded for being ambitious and powerful and successful, but women who display these same traits often pay a social penalty. Female accomplishments come at a cost. And for all the progress, there is still societal pressure for women to keep an eye on marriage from a young age. When I went to college, as much as my parents emphasized academic achievement, they emphasized marriage even more. They told me that the most eligible women marry young to get a good man before they are all taken. I followed their advice, and throughout college, I vetted every date as a potential husband, which, trust me, is a sure way to ruin a date at age 19. When I was graduating, my thesis advisor, Larry Summers, suggested that I apply for international fellowships. I rejected the idea on the grounds that a foreign country was not a likely place to turn a date into a husband. Instead, I moved to Washington, D.C., which was full of eligible men. It worked. My first year out of college, I met a man who was not just eligible, but also wonderful. So, I married him. I was 24 and convinced that marriage was the first and necessary step to a happy and productive life. It didn't work out that way. I was just not mature enough to have made this lifelong decision, and the relationship quickly unraveled. By the age of 25, I had managed to get married and also divorced. At the time, this felt like a massive personal and public failure. For many years, I felt that no matter what I accomplished professionally, it paled in comparison to the scarlet letter D stitched on my chest. Almost 10 years later, I learned that the good ones were not all taken, and I wisely and very happily married Dave Goldberg. Like me, Gail Zimok-Lamon, Deputy Director of the Council on Foreign Relations, Women, and Foreign Policy Program, was encouraged to prioritize marriage over career. As she described in The Atlantic, "When I was 27, I received a posh fellowship to travel to Germany to learn German and work at the Wall Street Journal. It was an incredible opportunity for a 20-something by any objective standard, and I knew it would help prepare me for graduate school and beyond. My girlfriends, however, expressed shock and horror that I would leave my boyfriend at the time to live abroad for a year. My relatives asked whether I was worried that I'd never get married. And when I attended a barbecue with my then beau, his boss took me aside to remind me that there aren't many guys like that out there." The result of these negative reactions, in Gail's view, is that many women still see ambition as a dirty word. Many have argued with me that ambition is not the problem. Women are not less ambitious than men, they insist, but more enlightened with different and more meaningful goals. I do not dismiss or dispute this argument. There is far more to life than climbing a career ladder, including raising children, seeking personal fulfillment, contributing to society, and improving the lives of others. And there are many people who are deeply committed to their jobs but do not, and should not have to, aspire to run their organizations. Leadership roles are not the only way to have profound impact. I also acknowledge that there are biological differences between men and women. I have breastfed 2 children and noted, at times with great disappointment, that this was simply not something my husband was equipped to do. Are there characteristics inherent in sex differences that make women more nurturing and men more assertive? Quite possibly. Still, in today's world, where we no longer have to hunt in the wild for our food, our desire for leadership is largely a culturally created and reinforced trait. How individuals view what they can and should accomplish is in large part formed by our societal expectations. From the moment we are born, boys and girls are treated differently. Parents tend to talk to girl babies more than boy babies. Mothers overestimate the crawling ability of their sons and underestimate the crawling ability of their daughters. Reflecting the belief that girls need to be helped more than boys, mothers often spend more time comforting and hugging infant girls and more time watching infant boys play by themselves. Other cultural messages are more blatant. Gymboree once sold onesies proclaiming, "Smart like Daddy," for boys, and "Pretty like Mommy," for girls. The same year, JCPenney marketed a t-shirt to teenage girls that bragged, "I'm too pretty to do homework, so my brother has to do it for me." These things did not happen in 1951. They happened in 2011. Even worse, the messages sent to girls can move beyond encouraging superficial traits and veer into explicitly discouraging leadership. When a girl tries to lead, she is often labeled bossy. Boys are seldom called bossy because a boy taking the role of a boss does not surprise or offend. As someone who was called this for much of my childhood, I know that it is not a compliment. The stories of my childhood bossiness are told, and retold, with great amusement. Apparently, when I was in elementary school, I taught my younger siblings, David and Michelle, to follow me around, listen to my monologues, and scream the word, "Right!" when I concluded. I was the eldest of the neighborhood children and allegedly spent my time organizing shows that I could direct and clubs that I could run. People laugh at these accounts, but to this day, I always feel slightly ashamed of my behavior, which is remarkable given that I have now written an entire book about why girls should not be made to feel this way, or maybe this partially explains my motivation. Even when we were in our 30s, pointing out this behavior was still the best way for my siblings to tease me. When Dave and I got married, David and Michelle gave a beautiful, hilarious toast, which kicked off with this. "Hi! Some of you think we are Cheryl's younger siblings, but really we were Cheryl's first employees. Employee number one and employee number two. Initially, as a one-year-old and a three-year-old, we were worthless and weak. Disorganized. Lazy. We would just as soon spit up on ourselves as read the morning paper. But Cheryl could see that we had potential. For more than 10 years, Cheryl took us under her wing and whipped us into shape." Everyone laughed. My siblings continued. "To the best of our knowledge, Cheryl never actually played as a child, but really just organized other children's play. Cheryl supervised adults as well. When our parents went away on vacation, our grandparents used to babysit. Before our parents left, Cheryl protested, 'Now I have to take care of David and Michelle and Grandma and Grandpa too. It's not fair.' Everyone laughed even louder. I laughed too, but there is still some part of me that feels it was unseemly for a little girl to be thought of as so domineering. Cringe. From a very early age, boys are encouraged to take charge and offer their opinions. Teachers interact more with boys, call on them more frequently, and ask them more questions. Boys are also more likely to call out answers, and when they do, teachers usually listen to them. When girls call out, teachers often scold them for breaking the rules and remind them to raise their hands if they want to speak. I was recently reminded that these patterns persist even when we are all grown up. Not long ago, at a small dinner with other business executives, the guest of honor spoke the entire time without taking a breath. This meant that the only way to ask a question or make an observation was to interrupt. Three or four men jumped in, and the guest politely answered their questions before resuming his lecture. At one point, I tried to add something to the conversation, and he barked, "Let me finish. You people are not good at listening." Eventually, A few more men interjected, and he allowed it. Then the only other female executive at the dinner decided to speak up, and he did it again. He chastised her for interrupting. After the meal, one of the male CEOs pulled me aside to say that he had noticed that only the women had been silenced. He told me he empathized because as a Hispanic, he has been treated like this many times. The danger goes beyond authority figures silencing female voices. Young women internalize societal cues about what defines appropriate behavior and, in turn, silence themselves. They are rewarded for being pretty like mommy and encouraged to be nurturing like mommy, too. The album Free to Be, You and Me was released in 1972 and became a staple of my childhood. My favorite song, William's Doll, is about a 5-year-old boy who begs his reluctant father to buy him a traditional girl's toy. Almost 40 years later, the toy industry remains riddled with stereotypes. Right before Christmas 2011, a video featuring a 4-year-old girl named Riley went viral. Riley paces in a toy store, upset because companies are trying to trick the girls into buying the pink stuff instead of stuff that boys want to buy, right? Right. As Riley reasons, some girls like superheroes, some girls like princesses. Some boys like superheroes, some boys like princesses. So why do all the girls have to buy pink stuff and all the boys have to buy different color stuff? It takes a near act of rebellion for even a 4-year-old to break away from society's expectations. William still has no doll, while Riley is drowning in a sea of pink. I now play Free to Be, You and Me for my children and hope that if they ever play it for their children, its message will seem quaint. The gender stereotypes introduced in childhood are reinforced throughout our lives and become self-fulfilling prophecies. Most leadership positions are held by men, so women don't expect to achieve them, and that becomes one of the reasons they don't. The same is true with pay. Men generally earn more than women, so people expect women to earn less. And they do. Compounding the problem is a social psychological phenomenon called stereotype threat. Social scientists have observed that when members of a group are made aware of a negative stereotype, they are more likely to perform according to that stereotype. For example, stereotypically, boys are better at math and science than girls. When girls are reminded of their gender before a math or science test, even by something as simple as checking off an M or F box at the top of the test, they perform worse. Stereotype threat discourages girls and women from entering technical fields and is one of the key reasons that so few study computer science. As a Facebook summer intern once told me, in my school's computer science department, there are more Daves than girls. The stereotype of a working woman is rarely attractive. Popular culture has long portrayed successful working women as so consumed by their careers that they have no personal life. Think Sigourney Weaver in Working Girl and Sandra Bullock in The Proposal. If a female character divides her time between work and family, she is almost always harried and guilt-ridden. Think Sarah Jessica Parker in I Don't Know How She Does It. And these characterizations have moved beyond fiction. A study found that of millennial men and women who work in an organization with a woman in a senior role, only about 20% want to emulate her career. This unappealing stereotype is particularly unfortunate since most women have no choice but to remain in the workforce. About 41% of mothers are primary breadwinners and earn the majority of their family's earnings. Another 23% of mothers are co-breadwinners, contributing at least a quarter of the family's earnings. The number of women supporting families on their own is increasing quickly. Between 1973 and 2006, the proportion of families headed by a single mother grew from 1 in 10 to 1 in 5. These numbers are dramatically higher in Hispanic and African American families. 27% of Latino children and 52% of African American children are being raised by a single mother. Our country lags considerably behind others in efforts to help parents take care of their children and stay in the workforce. Of all the industrialized nations in the world, the United States is the only one without a paid maternity leave policy. As Ellen Bravo, director of the Family Values at Work Consortium, observed, most women are not thinking about having it all. They're worried about losing it all. Their jobs, their children's health, their family's financial stability, because of the regular conflicts that arise between being a good employee and a responsible parent. For many men, the fundamental assumption is that they can have both a successful professional life and a fulfilling personal life. For many women, the assumption is that trying to do both is difficult at best and impossible at worst. Women are surrounded by headlines and stories warning them that they cannot be committed to both their families and careers. They are told over and over again that they have to choose, because if they try to do too much, they'll be harried and unhappy. Framing the issue as work-life balance, as if the two were diametrically opposed, practically ensures work will lose out. Who would ever choose work over life? The good news is that not only can women have both families and careers, they can thrive while doing so. In 2009, Sharon Mears and Joanna Strober published Getting to 50-50, a comprehensive review of governmental, social science, and original research that led them to conclude that children, parents, and marriages can all flourish when both parents have full careers. The data plainly reveal that sharing financial and childcare responsibilities leads to less guilty moms, more involved dads, and thriving children. Professor Rosalind Chait Barnett of Brandeis University did a comprehensive review of studies on work-life balance and found that women who participate in multiple roles actually have lower levels of anxiety and higher levels of mental well-being. Employed women reap rewards including greater financial security, more stable marriages, better health, and in general, increased life satisfaction. It may not be as dramatic or funny to make a movie about a woman who loves both her job and her family, but that would be a better reflection of reality. We need more portrayals of women as competent professionals and happy mothers, or even happy professionals and competent mothers. The current negative images may make us laugh, but they also make women unnecessarily fearful by presenting life's challenges as insurmountable. Our culture remains baffled. I don't know how she does it. Fear is at the root of so many of the barriers that women face. Fear of not being liked. Fear of making the wrong choice. Fear of drawing negative attention. Fear of overreaching. Fear of being judged. Fear of failure. And the holy trinity of fear. The fear of being a bad mother / wife / daughter. Without fear, women can pursue professional success and personal fulfillment, and freely choose one or the other or both. At Facebook, we work hard to create a culture where people are encouraged to take risks. We have posters all around the office that reinforce this attitude. In bright red letters, one declares, "Fortune favors the bold." Another insists, "Proceed and be bold." My favorite reads, "What would you do if you weren't afraid?" In 2011, Deborah Spar, president of Barnard College, an all-women's liberal art school in New York City, invited me to deliver its commencement address. This speech was the first time I openly discussed the leadership ambition gap. Standing on the podium, I felt nervous. I told the members of the graduating class that they should be ambitious, not just in pursuing their dreams, but in aspiring to become leaders in their fields. I knew this message could be misinterpreted as my judging women for not making the same choices that I have. Nothing could be farther from the truth. I believe that choice means choice for all of us. But I also believe that we need to do more to encourage women to reach for leadership roles. If we can't tell women to aim high at a college graduation, when can we? As I addressed the enthusiastic women, I found myself fighting back tears. I made it through the speech and concluded with this. You are the promise for a more equal world. So my hope for everyone here is that after you walk across this stage, after you get your diploma, after you go out tonight and celebrate hard, you then will lean way into your career. You will find something you love doing and you will do it with gusto. Find the right career for you and go all the way to the top. As you walk off this stage today, you start your adult life. Start out by aiming high. Try, and try hard. Like everyone here, I have great hopes for the members of this graduating class. I hope you find true meaning, contentment, and passion in your life. I hope you navigate the difficult times and come out with greater strength and resolve. I hope you find whatever balance you seek with your eyes wide open. And I hope that you, yes, you, have the ambition to lean into your career and run the world. Because the world needs you to change it. Women all around the world are counting on you. So please ask yourself, what would I do if I weren't afraid? And then go do it. As the graduates were called to the stage to collect their diplomas, I shook every hand. Many stopped to give me a hug. One young woman even told me I was the baddest bitch, which, having checked with someone later, actually did turn out to be a compliment. I know my speech was meant to motivate them, but they actually motivated me. In the months that followed, I started thinking that I should speak up more often and more publicly about these issues. I should urge more women to believe in themselves and aspire to lead. I should urge more men to become part of the solution by supporting women in the workforce and at home. And I should not just speak in front of friendly crowds at Barnard. I should seek out larger, possibly less sympathetic audiences. I should take my own advice and be ambitious. Writing this book is not just me encouraging others to lean in. This is me leaning in. Writing this book is what I would do if I weren't afraid. Chapter 2. Sit at the Table. A few years ago, I hosted a meeting for Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner at Facebook. We invited 15 executives from across Silicon Valley for breakfast and a discussion about the economy. Secretary Geithner arrived with 4 members of his staff, 2 senior and 2 more junior, and we all gathered in our one nice conference room. After the usual milling around, I encouraged the attendees to help themselves to the buffet and take a seat. Our invited guests, mostly men, grabbed plates and food and sat down at the large conference table. Secretary Geithner's team, all women, took their food last and sat in chairs off to the side of the room. I motioned for the women to come sit at the table, waving them over so they would feel welcomed. They demurred and remained in their seats. The 4 women had every right to be at this meeting, but because of their seating choice, they seemed like spectators rather than participants. I knew I had to say something. So after the meeting, I pulled them aside to talk. I pointed out that they should have sat at the table even without an invitation, but when publicly welcomed, they most certainly should have joined. At first, they seemed surprised, then they agreed. It was a watershed moment for me, a moment when I witnessed how an internal barrier can alter women's behavior, a moment when I realized that in addition to facing institutional obstacles, women face a battle from within. When I gave a TED talk on how women can succeed in the workforce, I told this story to illustrate how women hold themselves back, literally choosing to watch from the sidelines. And yet, as disappointed as I was that these women made that choice, I also deeply understood the insecurities that drew them to the side of the room and kept them glued to those chairs. My senior year of college, I was inducted into the Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society. At that time, Harvard and Radcliffe had separate chapters, so my ceremony was for women only. The keynote speaker, Dr. Peggy McIntosh from the Wellesley Centers for Women, gave a talk called Feeling Like a Fraud. She explained that many people, but especially women, feel fraudulent when they are praised for their accomplishments. Instead of feeling